Saturday, 1 a.m. I wake up on the wrong side of a baby grand piano. The steel strings imprinting circular patterns where they press uncomfortably into my wrists and ankles. The piano lid is closed, and I am unable to push it open. I don't especially enjoy the dark, cramped quarters, but the nicto and claustrophobias are nothing compared to the beating my ears are taking from the fiend who is playing saber dance on the instrument at several notches above the written fortissimo. The lateness of the performance and the prepared piano-like quality of the realization conspire against the manic musician, however, as several lodgers, assuming that I am in the same Puyallup, Washington hotel in which I began my evening, are roused from their slumberings. I can hear
I think all assumptions go by the boards you present.
What?
Assuming.
No. I am assuming.
All right.
I can hear them enter the room and berate my tormentor over his choice of performance venues. Finally, he or she stops. And at once I commence banging on the piano's lid and yelling. My voice doesn't sound at all like me. The words are in French, and at a tessitura an octave higher than normal. Instead of saying, "Help! Help! Let me out!" I say,
"Que des noms pincent épilétant sur vous du ciel."
Well, would you run that by me again, please?
Is that the one you want to make?
Yeah, no, that's right. Is that what it is?
Que des noms pincent épilétant sur vous du ciel.
I didn't write this.
That's right. That was written by a real French person.
Yeah, right.
Of course.
Huh.
Now I hear more voices, questioning one.
Questioning the translation.
No, this is authentic. And in fact, well, I have a... Never mind. Yeah. Questioning ones, followed by a scuffle, then a gunshot, a scream, the flapping of a large winged creature that I prefer not to know any details about, several pairs of footfalls rushing away. That's just... pathetic.
Well, I wasn't prepared.
All right.
I was driving into ditches.
And then silence. Somewhere off in the distance, a dog barks. I try the piano lid again, and this time I am able to push it open. I sit up and glance about. There is no one in sight. Though the room light is at best crepuscular, I spot the saber dance sheet music strewn on the floor. It is bloodstained. A smudged footprint is clearly visible on page 2 of the music, where the xylophone enters in the orchestral version. I estimate it is a size woman's stiletto boot worn by a left-handed man with a gibbous-shaped scar on his chin. It feels good to utilize my deductive reasoning, even though it will ultimately prove to be flat-out wrong. From just beyond the open window, I can hear that wing-flapping sound returning. Another muffled cry ensues, as does another gunshot, and more hurried footfalls. God, all right, fine. I'm building up to this...
Wait, I'll make better footfalls.
Fine. Now, I decide, would be an excellent time to join the others in the fray, and I struggle to extricate myself from the piano. But my right foot is caught between the low A-sharp string and its collateral hammer. The more I struggle, the more tightly wedged my foot becomes, and the nearer the outside commotion draws. I abruptly realize that all of this activity has diverted me from determining how I wound up inside the piano in the first place. But an inhuman howl, followed by a brilliant flash of blue-black light right outside the window again, commands my full attention. The sudden burst of light briefly... That's what you do with mucal parts lodged in your throat. I don't necessarily think that's... Anyway, I'm losing my track. The sudden burst of light briefly illuminated certain items in the room that I had not hitherto noticed. On the wall is a photograph of famed diva Maria Callas in waffle-soled clogs and magnetic apron, holding a $500 bill. Intuitively, I know that the picture was taken after...
The picture was taken.
Yeah.
Good job.
Was taken after she had returned from a whale-watching expedition on which she had successfully taught a larder beetle to sing light opera, and that she had won the $500 from a bicycle wheel spokesman for doing so,
and I remember that something about this larder beetle.
It has recurred.
Yes.
And it may again. Beneath the picture is a seed pod-shaped divan piled high with antimacassars featuring Industrial Revolution landscapes. And under the antimacassars lies an arthropoid torso that, holy body snatcher,
whoa!
Looks a lot like me. The discovery startles me, and as I shrink back in alarm, my foot conveniently slips free of its snare. Quickly, I vault out of the piano, pause to examine the footprint on the sheet music. Make that a crescent-shaped scar. Nope, still wrong.
Gibbous?
Nope, still wrong.
Okay.
Then dash to the door, slamming it shut behind me. The corridor in which I find myself doesn't look like any hotel hallway I've ever wandered down, filching do-not-disturb doorknob hangers. It is a narrow, 5-foot-high, oval-shaped tunnel cut into rock. 2 wooden torches jammed into the wall provide the only light. Ghostly shadows flicker on the rock face like animatronic Rorschach tests. Cautiously, I steal down the passageway, my senses alert for the paltriest oddity. After a quarter furlong, the light has waned to a dim gloom, and I nearly miss the ladder hanging down from an overhead hatchway. The bottom of the ladder trembles slightly, and as I pull myself up, rung by slippery rung, the vibration increases. By the time I'm at the top, the ladder is shuddering like a fidgety fan dancer in a meat locker. Slowly, I open the hatch. Saturday, 2:52 p.m. I reread a summary of the previous evening's events, naturally omitting those that would seem implausible even to the normally credulous to a fault listeners of Calvus and Damien's New Music Bazaar. When I come to the part about banging on the piano lid from the inside and shouting the French expression that translates as "May huge metal tweezers fall on you from the sky," I realize that this 289th episode is a lot more existential than the "somewhere in the distance a dog barked" metaphor, whose allegorical images must sooner or later hark circuitously back, not to Pielop, but to Calvos.
Who is, despite all other possibilities and options, actually here.
Yes. It was touch and go.
It was.
Orbit.
Let's listen to the conclusion of She Sings, She Screams by Mark Engebertsen, and Engebertsen will be right back. Richard Durlam playing there on the saxophone.
Holy saxophone.
Ingebrigtsen's She Sings, She Screams, the title track from a CD from Innova, number 543. That's a real good tune. We'll play that without without it being second saxophone to an essay someday.
Yeah. Yes.
Ah, well, we're going to hear a little Gert-Jan Prins in just a second. The reason we're late is because Calvos was driving along happily in his 1983 Dodge
Happy Mobile.
Happy Mobile, his nice truck, nice yellow truck named Stanley, and some reason the hood had been unlatched by some ruffian or scallion, and as I came around the curve at 50 miles an hour, the hood lifted, covering the entirety of my windshield, breaking two of the bolts holding the hood, and it sliding down and locking in place, completely obscuring my view, as at 50 miles an hour I had traffic ahead and traffic behind, and traffic coming the other way.
Are we supposed to feel what?
Nothing. I'm just having to say that so that I can use up the time until I play Gert-Jan Prins's piece called Sub One.
And at the top of the hour,
we'll have our interview with Brenda Hutchinson.
Yes.
Lots of fun. Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh, you have to come back and hear us in 5 minutes, despite this piece we're about to play.
Oh, right. And then later on, even as a best of the bizarre.
Oh, is there one of those
there
today?
There is indeed.
All right, all right. Here's some Gert-Jan Prins. This is Sub One. This is from a CD called Noise Capture.
This is James
this
Bond.
This is Eve Bagleri.
Hello, I'm Kyle Gann.
This is Jim Hi, this is Mary Jane Lee.
Hello, this is Michael Mann.
This is Gwyneth Walker.
I'm Eric Gunn, and I'm here to say, give it up.
You're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar.
You're a red alert for new music.
Here on WGDR Plainfield.
Wow, a whole collection, a whole raft of folks.
Yes, that's actually the introduction to our presentation we're going to give on Wednesday at the Paul Chappell, in Gotham, as we accept the ASCAP Deems Taylor Award. For
one this, of many.
But this year's Internet Award in concert music.
Mm-hmm.
The only one.
Yes.
The only one in that category, and we have it.
And yet we stoop to playing that stuff that preceded the
What, you didn't like that?
Little Herfian
Prince?
I found
noise
it
music? What?
Noise. That's right. It did annoy a bit.
Oh, gosh.
Maybe I'm simply getting futsy.
You must be. I can't imagine. That was just dandy. I listened to the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And survived. Well, now it's time for interviews.
Oh, fine. Yes, I'm ready for this.
We're going to head for Bregman Studios at Dartmouth College, and where we're going to talk to Brenda Hutchinson. And this is going to be just dandy, because I reviewed our interview, and it was lots of fun.
Oh, good.
So we're going to skip the first minute and 40 seconds, which mostly consisted of me ruining the microphone by putting batteries in and out of it. And we're going to go right to the cogent, coherent, and interesting part of the interview. Ready?
You mean there was one?
Well, the parts where we didn't talk.
Oh, all right, that part.
Unlike except for Vermont.
Yes.
Except for...
Okay, so are we official now?
I guess so.
Okay, well, I'll take these off. And. That's all right. That's all right. We like ambient sounds is our specialty on Calvos and Damien. We are here on the road again.
On the road, and it's particularly exciting that we're on the road because in radio time, in just under 2 hours, we will hear a program of road music. All Roads, I believe, is
Fender Roads?
Not Fender, but Dusty Roads.
Dusty Roads.
Dusty
okay.
Roads. And All Roads, where and All Roads lead to Carnegie Hall.
That's correct. That's what the name of it is.
Yes,
right.
which we'll discuss right. soon with our
guest.
Interviewer guest, our Brenda Hutchinson.
Say it with that. The aspirin.
Yeah. Hutchinson.
New Jersey. Hi, welcome.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for thanking us for being here.
Let's hear a little of your history. We were off mic and we heard some interesting stories. The compact version, because we heard a touch of an accent.
All right.
And Damien immediately traced it back to a sort of Southern New Jersey.
People ask me where I'm from all the time, and everybody in Trenton talks like this.
Trenton. No.
Trenton.
As close to this is impossible for a foreigner to say this word because it is a quasi two syllable word.
That's right.
Trenton.
I had friends from England who came to visit, and it was the first time I ever heard anybody pronounce it Trenton. It sounded so nice, but it wasn't the same place.
No, definitely not that. So how did you get sprung?
I went to college.
Where?
Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh.
Yes. That's not too far west, but started
as far
west.
As I was allowed to go. I wanted to go to Hawaii. So.
What did you study?
Music. Music composition.
Had you been doing music in Trenton?
Yeah, in Trenton, I did. I started out, I got a pink and white plastic Sony tape recorder for Christmas when I was really young, and I used to lock myself in the bathroom and record things.
Oh, I'm glad you said record things, because we've heard people do other things with Sony pink tape recorders.
That's right. And so you went to Carnegie, you studied, what kind of music did you study?
Regular stuff. You know, musicianship, ear training, blah, 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 real conservative, straight ahead musical education.
And then you just kept going west.
Yeah, right away. I did. I launched myself out west, and then I went to UC San Diego for graduate school.
There is quite an amazing UC San Diego connection that we've run into with composers that we've interviewed over the years.
Huh. Yeah, like...
We like them.
Well, my roommates, I roomed with Paul Drescher, Richard Svonar, and Bunching Lamb in one of Pauline
Richard
Oliveira's
Svonar.
Old houses. Yeah.
Amazing.
You know Richard?
We will,
New Jersey?
We will follow this connection later on, the Richard Svonar connection has, this has never been talked about on Calvus and Damien, but it will be at some point.
Oh, good.
Okay. So then you went west, you studied there, and then you started doing stuff.
Oh, yeah, I've been doing stuff anyway, but yeah. My thesis when I was at UCSC was on my grandmother, both the recordings and the written part. So.
And when did you record her, and can you, do you think that would be a good piece to begin listening to for an introduction to our audience?
I guess, but I don't think you do. I don't think you have her speaking. I mean, I recorded her.
We have the.
You have me talking about her.
You
right?
Talking yeah. about her? Yeah, yeah that's
like a 20-year project.
Yeah, the voice.
Yeah, I recorded her in 1977 mm-hmm. because at that time, I guess maybe I say in the notes, but she was starting to get senile, and she was the storyteller in the family, and she was starting to tell them differently than I remembered them. And so I wanted to record her before they were completely gone. And that's kind of how I got started doing those kind of things, those sort of documents, stories. So that's what I did for my thesis. I edited that, and it was an hour and a half piece. And then I wrote about sort of language and music and inflection and this and that. And I had to just sort of justify that by doing a first part of the thesis that was about musical characterization. And I had to analyze Harold in Italy, Bartong, and I don't really remember the other piece. And I talked about how much I hated that sort of thing, and because I think I would prefer people to be able to speak for themselves and not, you know, these abstract sort of make-believe things.
Which is quite evident on all the recordings that you have, and many of which that we will listen to.
Yeah, let's listen to one now. What's a good one to start with? And we'll get back, because we have so many questions for you.
Oh.
Some are true and false, but some are essays. So
yeah,
well, I don't know. I mean, if you start with me talking about my grandmother, it sounds pretty much like I'm talking right now. So maybe you want to do some of that.
Okay.
Story time.
Story time.
Let's do it.
From Voice, music by Brenda Hutchinson.
First, a song. It's not an original song. It's a song from a Saturday morning cartoon show in the late 50s and the early 60s called Cartoon Corner's General Store. And the host of the show was Gene London, and he used to sing the song, which was called Let's Pretend That It's Story Time. Uncle Scat was a TV repairman before he lost his legs. He wasn't really Scat. That was just his nickname. His name was Adam. But he probably got his name by being the 11th of 12 kids. He had two brothers named Anthony, too, but they had different fathers, so nobody really got confused. He wasn't always a TV repairman, either. He used to be a policeman. And when they made him retire, he set about to repair televisions. Whenever our TV would go on the blink, we'd call Uncle Scat, and he'd come over and open up the back of the TV. You don't have TV repairmen anymore, but he was a big man with a real quiet voice, and he'd just come in with his toolbox and take out the bad tubes, put in the new ones, and when he stopped doing that, we used to have strangers come to the house to fix the TV. It wasn't the same. But at some point he got diabetes and he had to stop repairing TVs because they had to start cutting his legs off. And they started, you know, first with one foot and the other, and then a little further up, a little further up, and they just kept chopping away at his legs. And finally, he got real irritable and his wife couldn't stand having him around anymore. She couldn't take care of him, so she put him in the state hospital. And he used to just sit there in the wheelchair by the door, because he would say, I don't belong here. There's all crazy people here. And we'd go visit him. I'd get my grandmother, and we'd go visit him. And I remember one time we brought him a pair of socks. You know, his legs only reached to the end of the seat, but they'd get cold. So we got him a pair of white athletic socks and put the socks on. And I remember looking at him and thinking how funny it looked. He had his little feet, his little short legs. And I knew that he looked at him and he could see how weird it looked, that he had his little feet coming off of above his knees. And we felt bad. But, he died there.
Story time. Stories of Brenda Hutchinson's grandmother from a recording called Voice.
Voice, V-O-Y-S. Say voice, say voice.
I don't know.
Does it mean something?
It's their title.
It's their series. It just seems so, like, tightly connected.
Oh, I see.
What you're
doing. So the real title is number 5.
It's Family Album. It's the title of
Family Album. Oh, I see.
Yeah,
there.
Of the
CD, right.
Okay.
It's Voice number 5.
A journal exploring sign in sound. So are the people signing on this CD?
I don't know. You wouldn't be able to tell.
Yes, no, not.
Let's go as far away from sort of the word thing, mm-hmm. to the long tubes.
Okay.
Talk about long tubes.
All right. Do you have anything in particular you want to know about?
Well, it's the technique first of all,
okay.
because we're going to hear this, and it would help if the listeners had a little clue
okay.
ahead of time
you
what
know,
they're
I
listening
have
to.
The tube here. I can sort of.
Ooh, you
Ooh.
Do. That would be great.
That works. Yeah.
Yeah. Terrific.
Okay. Well, when I worked at the Exploratorium in San Francisco, they had guests there from Bell Labs, and the guys came and they talked about how they were putting these electronic tones into really long tubes, and how certain sounds. Certain frequencies that they put in would disappear and you wouldn't be able to hear them. I thought, oh, that's very interesting. So I worked in the machine shop and I went and we had a metal rack there with lots of tubes and I sang into lots of different tubes and I found one that had a lot of notes that I couldn't sing. I pulled it out and it was a 9-foot tube. So the tube I use is a 9.5-foot tube, so it's just a little bit lower and it matches sort of the comfortable singing range of my voice with between the 3rd and 10th harmonics of the fundamental of this tube, which is A flat down near the bottom of the piano. So what happens in the case of a voice when you sing into the tube, the notes that can't be heard, what it's trying to do is some of the waves, you want me to explain sort of a little bit of the physics?
A little bit of the physics,
okay.
Sure.
One of the things is there's a mismatch in impedance between the amount of air in the tube, which is not very much when you compare it to the amount of air in the room. So some of the waves go down and they bounce back and come back up the tube. And the ones that come back up 180 degrees out of phase try to cancel out the closed end of the tube, which are my vocal cords. And you can feel it. You can do this. You could try this when I bring the tube in. It's like someone's touching your vocal cords and you try to sing certain notes and you just can't. And if you really try, you can get lots of distortion. And that's what I like and I find that interesting. And so I've been practicing for 10 years in all these places where you can't sing.
Hmm.
Trying different techniques for so it's really kind of unpredictable, and I like it for improvising for that reason, because you just don't know really what's going to happen.
Let's listen to one of those, and then when we get back from listening to this first, we're going to listen to Long Tube Trio.
Okay.
We won't listen to all of it. We'll listen to part of it, and then we'll be back in just a second. Our guest is Brenda Hutchinson.
Thank you.
Wow.
And she's back with her long tube.
I can't believe this got through the metal detector.
Did you fly with this tube?
Yes, exactly.
This is, you'd say this is, well, it's about 6 feet long. Oh, does it? Is it in sections?
The other part, yeah.
Oh.
It's a traveling version.
I see.
It's just a...
It's a weapon.
Just oh, yeah.
It's
oh,
just
yes.
a tube. It's just
an aluminum tube. Lightweight. An inch and a half diameter. And it's actually 9 feet, 6 and 7/8 inches long.
So it's lovely little
like the,
electrical tape.
Yes, it used to be...
seal it. I see.
I had set screws in there, but it's, they're stripped, so I just use the electrical tape here. Okay. Ready.
Good, all right.
Let's see. How do I do this?
Well, aim it at us, but we'll duck.
Okay.
Yeah, if you want to lean it on the edge of the chair, and that would be great.
Okay, well, I'll give you one
of way over on the other side of the room.
All right, well, this won't
and we'll get quiet.
You want a level? You want to try to
no, we won't need the level.
All right. I'll sing a glissando. And it, like, like that, okay? And now do it fast, like, so you can hear where it pops. So I'll sing in one of those places.
And the point is, you're not making the unusual sound yourself. It is the interaction of the tube length with the frequency of your singing.
Yeah. So, like that, is a note with a lot of harmonics. So, it goes after all the harmonics.
Good. Great.
Do you play sessions with this? Do you play? Do you sit in with bands, or do you have other people?
I have a group that I play with. Uh-huh. We improvise, And I just had this at northern Minnesota. I was there for 2 months, and I played the Tennessee Waltz a lot.
Can you do that now?
That's
it. Oh, right. Oh, sure.
Yes.
Amazing. All right, well, as you put that away, our guest is Brenda Hutchins with the Tennessee Waltz. I hope the licensing agencies are listening.
Well, you don't get to hear that every day on Cowboys and Damien.
No, but we might start playing that as a theme song.
Yeah, well, it's a good idea. Let's just take a little bit more of the Long Tube Trio, and then we'll get back to the interview.
Okay, we're back.
Can we? You did slip in the fact that you work at the Exploratorium, which is a keen interactive science museum on the water in San Francisco. How did you get there?
I had just finished a piece where it was called Apple Etudes, and it was from when I had first moved to New York, and I spent a lot of time recording in the streets and homeless people, and I did this really long piece in there. Like 12 studies, each one a portrait of a different person. And I had applied to do the piece at New Music America, but it was way too long. The person that was sort of one of the people doing New Music America, which was in San Francisco at the time, also ran the Speaking of Music program at the Exploratorium, so she invited me there to do it. So I went there, and that was the first performance, was in April of 1982. And when I saw the Exploratorium, I thought, oh, God, this is an amazing place. Frank Oppenheimer was still alive. He died in 1985. And I went back a few months later, and I just went into the electronics, because the guy in the electronics was my sound person. And I said, what can I want to work here. What can I do? And he said, well, they needed to wire the theater. And I knew how to solder. So I wired the theater. And then I finished that, and I went back, and I said, now what? You know, and little by little, I mean, I learned how to use machine tools and all kinds of things. But they didn't really pay me very much, and I only did work that nobody else wanted to do. So eventually I would have to go back to New York to earn enough money to live, and so I would go back.
What did you do in New York?
I worked at, eventually I got a job as an audio engineer. I worked as an audio engineer at Harvest Works.
Oh, Harvest Works, yeah. Sure.
So, because I lived there.
But now you are full-time at the Exploratorium?
Oh, no, I haven't worked there in like 7 years. But I still get my mail there. I have my email there. And I'm like an honorary lifetime member. I worked there for about 10 years, off and on, back and forth.
So do you have a home base now?
San Francisco,
But you work in New York?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I'm just trying to get my logistics right.
But mostly I'm in San Francisco now, and I just do projects in New York. Mm-hmm.
So what's your day job then?
We
love to ask that question. There's some bizarre day jobs.
Well, I've been away from home for 8 months this year. So
at the Exploratorium.
Huh?
Back at the Exploratorium?
I'm confused.
Me too. Oh, all right.
No, I taught for the spring semester. I taught at Overland in the summer. Let's see, I was in New York. I curated the Homemade Instrument Day there every other year in August. So, and then I was I had a McKnight Visiting Composer fellowship. So I was in the really remote wilderness area of northern Minnesota for 2 months working on a project. And then I just came here. So I just kind of move from thing to thing.
Wow.
I teach, I've done multimedia jobs, and, you know, and then I live off my credit cards when I want to.
Very well done.
Well, speaking of moving from place to place, let's talk about All Roads.
Okay.
We're going to hear a live performance of that tonight.
Right.
We've got to also hear a recorded performance. Let's start with the idea.
Okay.
Let's ask you, first of all, if you know some of the other people who travel with their pianos on the backs of their vehicles.
Yes.
Do you know Batya Weinbaum, by any chance?
Who?
Batya Weinbaum.
I don't know.
She's one of the composers who lived for a number of years in Vermont, still lives here, who traveled with a truck and a piano, and she and whoever would be there would improvise on the back of the truck.
Wow.
But she didn't ask for stories.
No, I knew. I met when I first moved to San Francisco, there were a lot of street performers. And there was one guy who had a white truck and a white upright piano, and he wore white tails and a hat, and he had a white rose in the vase. And he used to drive around and play the piano in the back of the truck. And I found out that as long as you don't put the truck on the ground, you don't need a permit.
Oh.
So, is that something?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so I remembered that, and when someone asked me to write a piano piece, knowing kind of what I do, I was more interested in the relationship that people have with the piano than actually sitting down and writing notes, and so I thought, well, I could rent a piano and drive around. I had a truck, and I was thinking, I'll drive around for the weekend and rent a truck and, rent a piano and record people. But by the time, that grant got rejected, and I applied again, and by the time years go by before these things happen, I thought, my piano's in New York and it's been in my friend's apartment for 4 years. Finally, I'll get my piano from New York and I'll drive across the whole country. And, I'll ask lots of people. And so I had to call and try to find somebody to give me a truck because it was a much more expensive proposition. And you all was the only one that called me back. Mm-hmm. I called all of them. I thought Ryder would be good because it was like, Oklahoma bombing.
Right.
Thought, this would be a good thing.
Yes, you
know.
Did, yeah.
They didn't even call me back. So
you got a U-Haul truck.
U-Haul gave me a truck and insurance and
stuffed your piano in it.
Yeah, I jammed. I had to tie it to the wheel well because when they asked me what size truck I wanted, I said, I wanted the smallest truck because it would be easier to handle. And some of the roads you can't go on with bigger trucks. But then when I got the truck, the piano wouldn't fit on the floor. So I put it on the wheel well, tied it to the side, and then people would sit on a cushion on the bench and so they would be high enough. And that's it. It had a definite list to the left.
Oh, way back.
And it sounded as if, at least on the recording, as if you didn't keep it in apple pie tuning all the time.
I tuned it at the beginning, and then I tuned it at the last day I drove it up to the Exploratorium. So I had a piano tuner come that morning. So and a lot of people played there, and that was it. And it went out to all the way across.
Yeah.
Detroit was the hardest on the piano because after I went there, some guy said, he said, man, this is a weird kind of out of tune. The bass is really out. And it was because of the potholes. I hit Detroit at rush hour, so I couldn't slow down. Bam, bam, bam. And I threw the whole bottom end of the piano out.
Oh, wow. Did you hit all parts of the country?
I went I started in New York City at a community garden. And I went through Yonkers and Kingston. And then I went to Boston. And then I went along the Great Lakes, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and then to North Dakota. And then when I got to North Dakota, I just went straight down the middle. Yeah. North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, and into Austin, Texas, and then across the Southwest. Yeah. So I couldn't go everywhere, but
no.
That was pretty good.
Did you cross the Dewey Bridge south of Moab in Utah?
I'm going to Utah.
Okay.
Sorry.
Let's take a break. Let's listen to the introduction.
Oh, fine, yes.
The talking to folks part of this, and then we'll get back to Brenda Hutchinson, our guest on Calvus and Damien.
I'm being recorded already. Someone told me that you had a piano and a truck. And I didn't know whether to believe it or not, and I came around here and I did see it, and she asked me to play. And I didn't want to because I haven't practiced in a long time. But I tried.
Piano story. I'm trying to think what would be a good piano story. Read a couple of notes. If I had too many piano stories, I'd skip down. I'm mostly playing the guitar.
Read the music by skipping.
Searching for the lost chord.
I was never forced to play when I was little.
So they gave me the option of practicing or quitting, so I decided to quit.
Odd children who had to beg.
Every time I wanted to feel a little creative, sat down and pounded.
Music was
and that's what you heard today.
So I just decided that success without passion wasn't important.
If I wanted to be good, I'd have to practice every day.
I wanted to learn, but not exactly wanted to learn.
For a
the whole thing about piano.
I like the piano.
I had a passion for it,
since I was in grade school. Like, I
took piano lessons for a while, and then I had to stop because we couldn't afford to pay the piano teacher.
Anyway,
God's gift to the world.
I just kept away by sound.
I like it and everything, but I don't know, I'm just not that type of person.
And so there was this huge sort of gap between what my ears wanted to do and what my hands could do.
That's just something that I came up with in the hospital, you know. Hey, people used to tell me that really relaxes us,
like,
you know.
I like the piano because, you know, then I can get a lot of voices. So
for the most part, I'm probably just going to play on the white keys because that's where I'm most comfortable.
I took up ragtime, and I've been hard-pressed to play anything else.
I haven't played piano. I've just been around piano. I haven't played no piano.
I've been piano for 8 years.
And I mean,
well, I'm in my 70s now, and I'm really trying to memorize, but I just can't do it. I just can't do it, but I do remember everything that I learned when I was young.
Every time I tried to do
first of all, my brother, when he started taking piano lessons,
you'll never
I was thinking,
amount to anything.
I want to take piano lessons too.
So I believe it.
Well, first it was me, but then, you know, he became so good,
it's
so
clear with my mother,
I wasn't asked anymore.
You must stop playing piano when Daddy comes home from work. She had visions of me being a concert pianist, but didn't work out that way.
She wanted me to play all stupid music and pitter-patter raindrops
on
the
like
housetop or something. So
I
went to three lessons,
like
and I hated the lady, and I quit.
I don't know. She just wasn't nice. I mean, I feel badly because she's dead now.
Well, I took piano lessons from a very wonderful person, and we always talked about food, and I think
that's
why I
went
from the piano.
You're still making your money even if I don't come to my lessons, but she doesn't appreciate that. She appreciates it as an art form.
Yeah, it's nice. I envy the people who can play pianos. I wish I had learned. I couldn't. I mean, I never learned. You know, I didn't like music, so I guess that's the reason why I don't play piano. You gotta like the music. I mean, you gotta want to learn it. I didn't at the time. Now I regret it. I wish I had. I'm not motivated.
I'm playing a piano
was the introduction to All Roads, How Do You Get to Carnegie Hall?
Which we will soon be hearing live.
Live, and so we'll probably, in Radio Time, we'll probably have be interspersing this recording in the live, depending on how things work out. We don't know. Isn't
how
that
clever
nice?
Of us.
Speaking of not knowing, what were your expectations when you started out, and how were they met or not?
Well, I had thought most people, at least, had touched a piano. And I thought a lot more people had experience with the piano than it turned out did. So that was a surprise to me. Because I'd say half the people that I recorded had never played the piano before. And most of the people that I asked to play said no.
Really?
Yeah, I would ask people, would you like to play my piano? Hmm. And they said no. So then I changed the question. I just would ask people if they would play it. And they more people all said okay. So that's kind of interesting. People don't want you to do them a favor, but they'll do you one.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I thought,
that
was interesting. And then finally I just started asking people, have you ever played the piano? Cause I didn't care.
More from All Roads, How Do You Get to Carnegie Hall? How do you get to Carnegie Hall? That's the question. By the way, speaking of Carnegie Hall, we are all the doors you hear opening and closing are the fact that we are seated in the main room.
We just got in the wrong place there. That was my doing. Let me get us back to the correct place, and then I'll be much happier, because she was telling us how she talked people into doing this. Oh, my goodness, my goodness.
And listening, it seems like the traumatic state was present for a lot of people.
A lot of people, and people's hands would shake. And I felt bad. I mean, on the one hand, to sort of have created this situation where people, but then they were willing, they were the ones, the brave ones, that got into the truck, so.
Can you imagine how many people you've sent to therapy?
I know people who have started taking their piano lessons again, though, as adults.
Did you keep in touch?
Yeah, well, some people I knew.
Oh,
and
right.
I had everyone. Oh, I forgot to bring the buttons. I had everyone sign a book with their name and address, and I gave everyone, I had little buttons made. It said, "How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice."
Yep.
And I was going to bring them for the people tonight, but I forgot.
Oh.
So,
what kind of recording equipment did you use?
I had a Panasonic DAT machine,
mm-hmm.
and an Audio Technica A25 stereo microphone.
Stereo mic, that's a nice stereo mic.
I opened it with an upright, so I opened the lid a little bit, and I wedged in a piece of wood, and then I just jammed the microphone in the middle. And that would, I used that to record the piano, and then when I wanted people's stories, I would just reach over before they could really think of anything, and I'd switch one leg of the tape recorder to a lavalier. So I have like one side of the active over there, still get the ambience, and then, you know, I record them talking.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So, expectations and fulfillment, how did that work out?
Well, that was the one that I hadn't realized, was that there would be so many people that did not play the piano. And I didn't really have any other than that, any expectations. I thought more people would be willing to do it.
Did you think it would be like more fun, or?
I definitely thought it'd be a lot more fun.
Okay, if I was struck by a certain overarching sense of discomfiture and sometimes terror.
Yeah, I thought it would be. I mean, I thought it'd be a lot more fun for me. But mostly, I'd say one in ten people said yes. So it was mostly an exercise in rejection. It's awful. You know, I just stand out there like a carny barker asking people to come. You could see the piano, and I stop and I blow up balloons. I had a little banner made, and, you know, I'd pull up the back of the truck, and I was just asking people to come, begging people to come into the truck. So, yeah, I didn't really have expectations in terms of content or anything, you know, and I didn't know what I would do with it all when I got it, because I had to make a piano piece out of it.
Take another listen, and we'll be back from All Roads, How Do You Get to Carnegie Hall, by Brenda Hutchinson, and friends and acquaintances and people who just dropped by, and we'll be back.
My piano story is a brief one, and it took place on an Easter. And the Easter Bunny had come and hidden all the goods down in the living room, and we all came down and we found everything. And then afterwards, my father said, I think there's something that you haven't found yet. And we said, what could it be? And then finally we went over and we looked, and on the piano there were licorice jelly beans on every single one of the black keys. And we hadn't even seen them. It was very exciting. So that's my only piano.
Yeah, that's what I associate with the piano and playing piano and hearing piano. After half a year, I think, after half a year after I started learning piano, playing, my youngest brother started learning tune. He's 2 years younger than I am. And he already played the piano without knowing musical notes or scores. So very soon he was like a lot better than I was.
My teacher always had a great piano in the house, and my mother used to play it. She used to play the Moonlight Sonata. She would be dressing for him, and she'd go, "Just play the Moonlight Sonata, just soothe your nerves." And I thought she was just great. I really did. She was just brilliant. And then I realized now, looking back at it, that she never ever played anything else. She never did anything else. And then when they moved to a house that didn't have a piano, I was like, why could I? How could you do that? How could you do that? But when I was a child, as a teenager, one of the most soothing things in my world was to
play. Yes, I was jealous at the time because he was exempt from tasks, household, you know, stuff. He didn't have to clean because he had to practice. He didn't have to clean the dishes, or he didn't have to vacuum clean, and we had to be quiet. So we always had to walk around the house.
I grew up around pianos. My mom played piano. She grew up playing piano. I think they had a music room in their house, and I have their music. I have collections of music from my grandparents. I mean, in those days, everybody sang around the piano, and it was just part of what people did for fun. So I grew up around pianos, and my teenage years especially was my way of escape. I just sat and practiced for an hour. My father would be sitting there reading whatever he read. I would be taking all this home. You know, it was just my way of sealing myself off from the world. I played mostly classical, but I played a lot of the songs that my mom had collected as a girl, I guess, and this is one of the ones that she had in her collection.
When I was a kid, we had a really neat piano in our house, an old upright piano, and I improvised on it from the time I was a preschooler, and then I just left them later. But things, I guess, it's not a specific story, but it's just that there was always a pianist to the piano playing in my house when my father would come home at night from work. Because my father was very, a very angry person. And so it was always clear with my mother that we must stop playing piano when Daddy comes home from work.
More from All Roads, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? How do you get to Carnegie Hall? That's the question. By the way, speaking of Carnegie Hall, we are all the doors you hear opening and closing are the fact that we are seated in the main room at Bregman Studios at Dartmouth College before the concert tonight. So we don't know how it's going to see. Here comes someone else through the door. So we are, as always, Calvis and Damien, live on the scene.
On the scene, on the road. Speaking of on the road, one of your CDs was rather intriguing to me, The Violet Flame, where you went to visit, I believe, your sister, who was at the Church of the Church Universal Triumphant. Is
Church Universal and Triumphant, yes.
Please tell us about that.
Well, they're in Montana.
Yes, indeed.
In Emigrant, Montana, which is just near the north gate of Yellowstone Park, the Wyoming-Montana border, about 30 miles north of there. And my sister had been in this church when she was a teenager.
she got involved after she sort of, she went through a lot of drugs, and then she was, you know, like a Jesus freak, and then she got into this church, and then she got out of it for a while when she was married, and then when her husband died, she was just 28 years old, and she moved back to, she had gone to Montana for her honeymoon. They had gone to the Grand Tetons, and she loved it there, and she moved back there, and the headquarters of the church had also moved there. They had been in Los Angeles. They had what was called Camelot when they were in Los Angeles, and they sold their parcel of land in Los Angeles and bought 77,000 acres in Montana, just bought Malcolm Forbes Ranch, and that's where the headquarters is. And so once she started to have children, I got kind of worried, because I figured, well, she's there, and she's going to be there, and I wanted to see for myself what it was like. I'd heard about, you know, oh, it's a cult, and they do brainwashing, and, you know, all this, and so I went there, and I was nervous. You know, I was afraid. I was afraid, and then I realized that, well, if you can be brainwashed, you'll be unbrainwashed. And so, because I was sort of guarded a little bit, which I think would be the other way around. And then I just asked people, why are you here, and how is your life different now than it was before? It's like I always try to find some key question to get people to just talk about anything. Mm-hmm. So, and those were the questions, and people would just talk. But they do this chant. This chanting,
yes.
The violet flame, and that's what the title of the piece is. They chant for all colors. Blue is, I don't know, protection and everything. Well, the violet flame is the one that is for burning up karma. And their one overarching thing in their religion is that they don't want to be reborn. They want to, at the end of this life, they want to become ascended masters. And then the only way you can do that is if you burn up all your karma. And so they have a special dispensation from Saint Germain. They don't have to burn all their karma, just 51%. And so they do
51%. It was really like 51%. They talk in those terms, yes.
Yes, uh-huh. Yes, these are quotes. And so the way that you can do that is by the violet flame, the chants for the violet flame, each repetition counts as something. And so they do it really fast so that you can get through a lot of them. And the more you do, the more karma you burn. So that's what the violet flame is.
Mm. Let's hear some.
Oh, yes.
From Violet Flame by Brenda Hutchinson. This is from 1993.
Come again as I meditate upon each day, as I call forth thy memories from the scroll of immortal love. I am thrilled anew, patterns wondrous to behold enthrall me with the wisdom of thy creating scheme. So fearfully and wonderfully am I made, that none can mar thy design. None can despoil the beauty of thy holiness. None can discourage the beauty of my heart.
Beautiful day of clouds and blue skies, and all of a sudden I found myself playing on the Nile River in the sand. I just knew intuitively, I knew in my being, I was on the Nile and I was playing. And by, I just floated back to my sandbox in Red Bank. So I ran and I asked my mother what happened, and she said, "You've remembered a past life."
Elizabeth Clare Prophet was going to be at the University of Penn. So I went to see her. And she's just talking and talking and talking. And I can remember everywhere she moved, I saw purple. If you can't touch it, I don't see it. And I've never seen anything, but I saw this field of purple all the way around her whole being. And I don't really remember too much of what she had to say, because I kept trying to figure out how they were making this purple come out of her.
Because people are saying, "Well, why do you want to go to Montana for? It's so cold up there." Well, I got friends up there. Sometimes I think when you get my age and you get to feeling bad, then you get down, you know. And you wonder what's going to happen to you.
You're in right now is the entryway, and there's many scenarios to having to use this, and so some of them, what we're designed for is worst cases you can put together. If you would have come in and had been contaminated by fallout, you'd washed down with a hose, which is over here, and then you'd step into this area, which is our decontamination area, and someone would help you wash down in here. And
I like carrots and fried beans and burritos, lots of sweets, mainly cold sweets, but sometimes they're a little bit too cold and I get my eyes watery, and I like the church. The embodiments of the Ascended Masters are the most interesting to me. My favorite is Saint Germain. He is sort of like very magical, and at least this is what our church believes. He can go through walls and stuff like that. They think that's neat.
Okay, what blessing are we going to do?
On Buddha.
I'm going to do God our Father.
God
our Father,
God our Father, once again,
thank you for our blessings.
This is Canary Burton, another composer, happy to be listening to Calvos and Damian's New Music Bazaar, your red alert for new music.
Here on WGDR Plainfield. That was, yes, excerpts from Violet Flame, a composition by Brenda Hutchinson, our guest today on Calvos and Damian. We're going to have some interesting stuff next week with the rest of the interview with Brenda, including a extended excerpt from the How Do You Get to Carnegie Hall piece.
From one of the pianists.
Yes, from a very interesting story. And a stunning piece called Voices of Reason, very difficult piece as well, which was recorded in an asylum in New York.
Hmm.
And we'll hear a few other interesting things, some more tubes as well,
right,
and
right.
Of course, Iya.
Iya.
Iya, a piece which is hard to believe until you hear it. Well, must be.
Must be then time for.
Best of Bazaar!
Mark 57! Presenting listenable snippets from episodes
281
through
285.
Best of the Bazaar.
Yes, General. You know, it's like hearing voices. So, I'm a professor. Academics are people who profess to know something.
Oh, man!
There's just nothing like it.
La,
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 la, that's the Middle Ages. However, pop, pop, pops up, pop, pop, pops out. This is going to be the Pythagorean diatone. However,
never pretty.
And then I have a gong for Gothic horror. And I can go on and on. Every piece is like that.
Why not?
Ta ta. What is this? Faith popcorn.
Not this week.
I don't know. Completely.
So, yes, when I did that for a week, and I'm thrilled with shortness.
Blood sucking.
Yeah.
So that's not far.
Keep going.
All right, where was I?
Sure. Boom, 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 boom.
And the raven.
Sex addiction. From the ugly duckling through beauty and the...
Low leaves vomit.
I guess we know what that's about.
Ah, vomit.
People respond very well. I mean, unless someone tells them... That's just the most famous person. Unless someone... Pop, pop, pop. Pop, pop.
Impression, a few grandparents
lying
to my, their children.
Unless someone...
La,
la.
Very so sort of I don't know, it's just the thing
but unfortunately
too
quick.
Mm-hmm.
I could find anywhere.
We have wrinkles on our face.
Said the queen, turning purple.
How input.
She was a visitor.
Sure.
Really buys
spit.
I've been to that. Bumping, bumping.
You're sure?
Let's just give it a couple of seconds.
We
here.
Have another start ID.
Let's see what this is. This is it.
This is it. Okay,
sorry.
So this is the Best of the Bizarre.
We just heard Best of the Besto 56.
And if there's anything we want to do is never hear one over again.
No, why not? All right.
And now it's time for Best of the Bizarre.
Mark 57, I promise, presenting little snippets
from episode 61 through 85 here at Best of the Bizarre. Okay, settles into a zone. And then that okay. Here's another one.
Yes,
the winter fly has died of old age.
Okay.
We know it. There's just nothing like it.
Do not.
What's our message?
Let me say this about that.
Yeah.
With a laptop top.
Welcome to the pot hit the button.
Can I say maybe?
Yes.
Oh.
No, thanks. Just sit. Well, you know. It's all in the tuning.
I was young, you know, and I'd just be standing there with my bull. I didn't have no meal, but I had a bull.
Oh, Lord, help us all.
And you know, there were weird things in the sky.
It's like nowhere.
It's very, very structured. I feel stupid.
We are in gratitude.
Right.
They are what they are. Box it up.
I don't know yet.
In my medicine cabinet.
Go for it.
Nice track.
Go for it.
Yes. And I can go on and on. Every piece is like that.
What is this?
I don't know.
Blood sucking.
25, 26. I guess we know what that's about.
Here's another one.
Hit the button.
This is the only voice.
Say what it would have.
That I could find anywhere.
Turning purple.
She was a visitor.
Bomping, bomping.
I like this.
Nothing is written. The answer would, boy, be, well, the, oh, boy, thank you. Let's see. I two-hand do.
Wow. You know, it's that kind of night, anything could happen.
Enough.
Best of the Bizarre, Mark 57.
Last.
Presenting listenable snippets from episodes
281
through
285.
At last. I guess there was just something about that number 56 that wanted to be heard again. I don't know why.
I don't know why, because no one would ask for it.
Maybe so someone under medication?
It was self-insisting. Ah, but 50, whatever that was, 7 was certainly had some good moments.
Nice fits, yes.
Energy. Let's listen to a little bit, speaking of energy. Here's something from Jim Connolly and the Gove County Philharmonic, as it's called. This is a piece called House of Cards.
Thank you. we're supposed to say, oh, how cute, bitonality again?
You can say that.
All right, I'll say, oh, my, how cute, bitonality again. Not that I'm being prejudicial or anything.
Well,
talk about this.
Yeah. No, I'm not going to talk about it. It's a lovely little piece. It reminds me a bit of Shostakovich's Age of Gold and a little bit of Stravinsky's, what was the name of that ballet there, Petrushka? And just about anything else that was written at least 50 years ago.
Right.
Okay. Jim Connolly on the Gove County Philharmonic. No wonder they called it Philharmonic. Okay. House of Cards. All right. No, it was fun. It's the kind of stuff you use for radio back. Okay. Jim,
we couldn't talk over it.
We could have, but we didn't.
We didn't.
Because we're such good folks. Instead, we're going to listen to Sinusoidal Tendencies, or Sinusoidal. I don't know how you pronounce that.
Sinusoidal
Tendencies. This is Philippe Mancione, and this will take us quite a ways into the end of the program. But
not close enough.
Not close enough, and it'll certainly keep you turning that dial somewhere else. Here it is, Philippe Mancione's Sinusoidal Tendencies. I'm not going to do that.
More fun with modulation?
Yes. From Sinusoidal Tendencies, music by Philip Mantione. That's from Sonic Circuits 8, music from Innova Records. They put out that whole series. Some of it is quite excellent. Some of it is average.
Mm-hmm.
Most of it is average or above. For an electroacoustic series, that's pretty darn good.
Right.
We have some commentary coming on CD next month, by the way, from Artemiev from Moscow. He's got a 10-minute piece for us, conversation about how things are doing there, many miles from here. And next week, of course...
You mean he isn't calling in?
No. He's actually sort of doing some radio art for us.
Oh, okay.
So we'll hear that from Artemiev, whose daddy was a very fine film composer, well-known for adventure-type movies. Not spaghetti westerns, but a notch up or two from that. Good stuff.
Oh, all right.
And next week, the second half of our interview with Brenda Hutchinson, we'll bring you back news from Gotham, from our celebration down there, to see if not only do they invite us, but they actually do feed us and give us a check.
And see how much of our show they swallow hook, line, and
sinker. Oh, sure, that'll happen. All right, let's wrap it up with a laid-back piece from a guy by the name of Charles Smith. This is the second part of Nico Wolverine, called Of One Forbids. Till next week. of One Forbids, music from Nickel Wolverine by Charles Smith, or Chaz, I think it just says Chaz here, that on Cold Blue, the first time we have an opportunity to play CDs from Cold Blue. And we're still here.
We are. We're looking for our replacement, our follow-up show, and she has not yet appeared.
So that gives us an opportunity to play some stuff from the WGDR library of easy listening new music. And to remind everyone that Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar is certainly made possible by lots of folks, not just us, but contributors and helpers and everyone else. And
our vast staff.
Our vast network of supporters. And they include Greg Hall today and the Argosy Foundation. So we thank them for helping us out with our program. Next week, again, Brenda Hutchinson will be here for the second part of the interview. And now some stuff we just don't normally play on this show. So we're just going to...
Good old Philip Glass. And this is part of his Hero Symphony. Although we have played Phil in the past, we don't hearken. We don't dwell on it.
No.
But we will now, since we don't want to get any of our own CDs out. So Hero Symphony by Philip Glass.
A production of Multimedia.